The Heart of Danger by Michael D. Cooper, Part 1, Under the Red Sun. Chapter 1, The Return of the King, February 30th, 2157. Dawn light shone through a large open window. A mild aroma of dew-covered blossoms wafted into the room, and the warblings of birds provided a comforting, peaceful sound. No one would have guessed that the setting was far underground. 5 miles straight up was a close, jumbled mountain range on the edge of a wide desert where frigid driving winds frequently scoured the sand. In spite of the apparent beauty of an early spring morning, the inhabitants of the room were unaware of its attractions. A cluster of tall, slender figures hovered over a gurney upon which lay an unconscious man. A soft white cushion supported him, its contours matching the shape of his body. He was covered from ankles to abdomen by a light green sheet. "Report," said a woman without looking up. Her features were soft but intense, eyes fixed on the unconscious man. Long brown hair was drawn back over her ears and gathered at the nape of her neck with a silver ring. 4 other people in attendance responded to her request in turn. "Temperature rising to normal," said a young woman. "Respiration less than 3 breaths in a minute," responded a man. "Rehydration complete, all systems functioning," stated an older man. "Blood flowing at near normal rate. Pressure is within normal limits. Blood gases," the man referred to a gauge that was connected by tubes to the unconscious individual's extremities. "Blood gases?" queried the first speaker, raising his eyes to look at the middle-aged man, whose brow was furrowed in concentration. "The last trace of illness should be eliminated in 10 to 12 breaths. Blood gases will then be normal." He looked up, raised his eyebrows slightly, and pressed his lips together, then nodded briefly. "Very well, then," murmured the brown-haired woman. She sighed and looked around the room. 4 monitors showed regular patterns. She turned to her right and saw the master screen suspended from the ceiling. She called out a sequence of somatic indicators. With each, the screen changed to show graphs, waves, or colors. A minute passed. "Blood gases?" requested the woman a second time. Without taking his eyes off the gauge, the man said quietly, 2 breaths. Throughout Imla Taltani, the refuge of twilight, an unnatural pause had put a stop to all activity. The thoughts of all 182 inhabitants of the refuge were occupied with the events that were coming to fruition in the heart of the community. Stenafi and Jogram were sitting silently together in the fern grotto. "I am sad for him," said Stenafi. "Yes," agreed Jogram, "he will not awaken to the world he had hoped for. He will return to a world like the one he left. To him the loss of Santilla, his father, will be fresh. His father's death and the defense of Amanya will be only weeks in the past for him. Now he must rise to take his father's place and become High King of Amanya, not in a world of peace and beauty, but once again to lead Amanyans into battle against our ancient enemy. He was successful when he led the counterattack against the Xenobots in Omega Centauri. He returned to see Amanya ravaged." Stenafi swallowed. "More than 12,000 years have passed, but he will see a world that has changed little. Do you think," Stenafi paused for a moment, and her voice caught, "do you think that he will believe that we have failed?" Jogren did not answer for a long time. Then no, he said. "Prince Ismaka is wise, so the histories tell us. He is wise and gentle, though his glance is piercing. It is not that Amanya has failed. It is that the Xenobots proved to be more resilient than any of that generation thought. I feel so sorry for him. He will awaken to grief." "The elder awoke to grief." "Yes, and his heart was broken. He barely speaks now. He is old, and he is lonely. Yes, but more than anything, he is grieved with a grief that no one can assuage. I wonder again, Sanofi paused, and her eyes filled with tears. I wonder if Prince King Ismaca will be broken by grief. He will not, asserted Jogren. He will give heart to the Amanyan race. There is much he must be told, but he will be eager to learn and to lead. And there are two factors that make his awakening different from the time of his suspension. Sanofi looked at him, her brown eyes showing depths of emotion. Jogren continued, The Xenobots are at the end of their racial life. Though they can still do much harm and may even exterminate our race, they cannot survive much longer. The galaxy will soon be rid of them, even if we lose the war. Sanofi smiled. And the other factor, she asked? Jogren smiled. You know we have the heroic and strong and fresh people of Earth as our allies. Yes, whispered Sanofi gladly, staring over Jogren's shoulder into the place among the ferns where the water was flowing briskly. I know. That means everything. She smiled again. Now, announced the middle-aged man quietly, and he raised his eyes from the gauge to the unconscious man. The long process is completed. He is no longer suspended. Now he sleeps a natural sleep. Ismaca's features looked warm. Dark wavy hair flowed back from his brow. His breathing quickened measurably. It was clear that he had moved from a deep, trance-like state to normal sleep and then to shallow sleep. Remove the equipment, said the brown-haired woman in a whisper. Slender hands quickly and gently removed tubes and wires where they had been affixed to the man's extremities. The woman watched carefully to ensure that the movements were gentle and would not disturb the man on the gurney. When she looked back at him, she saw that his eyes were open. Her own eyes opened a little wider, and she inhaled quickly. A slight intake of breath. She froze. The others froze as well. One very slowly put down the tube he had been coiling without removing his gaze from the figure on the gurney. The man on the gurney took a shallow breath and exhaled, and his mouth worked for a moment. He blinked. Then he moved his eyes to the left and lowered his brows slightly. He took another breath. He turned his head to the right and fixed his eyes on those of the brown-haired woman. "Ah," he said, and then took a deep breath and exhaled grandly. "How long have I slept?" No one answered. Then, "Bring the king his clothes," said the brown-haired woman. September 1, 2157. Soft grassy turf ran to the very edge of the island where there was a small dock and several pleasure boats tied up. A houseboat nestled at the head of the dock, accessible by a short flight of stairs from the meadow above. At the top of the stairs began a profusion of thick grass and low flowers that shouted their colors of bright red, orange, and yellow in the early morning sunlight. For 100 yards no trees rose skywards. Not even a bush overtopped the tall grasses until the sward came to a ring of palm trees beyond which cultivated fields lay open to the tropic sun. An eighth of a mile or so on either side of the dock, two spits of land extended into the ocean, forming between them a placid bay. There was nothing that would suggest to the casual observer that the island was artificial, that it was, in fact, an immense, self-contained floating city known throughout the world as Starlight Academy. The Academy was located 250 miles west of Espiritu Santo Island in Vanuatu, the closest significant landmass. The facility was home to nearly 15,000 personnel, students, instructors, administrators, researchers, and maintenance workers with a variety of skills. 9.5 square miles of meadows, palm groves, fields and farms, and flower gardens ringed a complex of buildings, stadia, and landing fields. More than 90% of the academy was below ground, dropping down more than a mile into the ocean depth of the South Pacific. Beneath the surface were the dormitories, most of the classrooms, many workshops, refectories, recreation halls, quarters for support systems, and laboratories for deep-sea research and other endeavors. Three starmen, David Zip Foster, Mark Seaton, and Joe Taylor, had returned from Mars a week earlier and enjoyed several days' visit with their families in Admonson City on the moon. Then they had gone to the Academy as celebrity lecturers for the winter term, where each had addressed classes on the topics of the 10th planet, the Europan Sea, and tachyon science for communication and transfer. Their visit had culminated in a presentation to the entire student body of more than 10,000 on Amanian life and culture. This lecture had proved to be the most popular in the history of Starlight Academy. Now the starmen were able to enjoy a short rest and were taking their ease in a small rowboat about 50 yards off the shore of the Academy's grassy south meadow. To the horizon there was nothing to see but ocean, barely undulating in the near-perfect weather. The peninsula to the west showed one or two old buildings, almost ramshackle in appearance, but which contained the weather monitors for the entire South Pacific. The peninsula to the east was bare. "Get any nibbles yet?" asked Mark Seaton. Dark of hair, brawny and reserved, at 24 years old, was the oldest of the three starmen. He was leaning back on his seat with a hat pulled down over his face. "Thankfully, no," answered Joe Taylor. "I'm too relaxed to want to make the effort to pull in any fish. I am almost sorry I actually put bait on the hook." The lanky blonde starman lay sideways on another seat and rested his feet on the side of the boat. In both hands he held a fishing pole. The third member of the party, red-headed David Foster, was sprawled out next to Mark. Shortest of the three, he was the informally acknowledged leader of the trio. "Good thinking, Joe," he said. "We've got, 3 days until we have to go to Tharsis for the strategy meeting. Things will begin to jump then, I predict, and we'll have precious little time for resting after that. Let's make the most of the time now. I'm enjoying being busy doing nothing." He arched his back in a pleasant stretch and then collapsed again into utter peace. 10 minutes later, Joe said, "Well, I am getting hungry, though. Suppose we return this coracle to the dock and amble over to the closest refectory." He began to wind his reel in slowly. After he'd set his pole down, he and Mark each took an oar and brought the rowboat back to the dock, where Zip jumped out and tied it fast to the pilings. A persistent calm and fullness expressed itself upon the minds of the starmen at the sight of the slow, pulse-like rise and fall of the deep, unrippled waters against the bank of the island. The hollow sound of their boots echoed as they walked along the dock and then ascended the stairs to the flowery meadow. A narrow path cut its way through the grasses toward the inner parts of the island. The three starmen followed it in quiet enjoyment of their friendship.